Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today is Jeremy Goldkorn, publisher of the indispensable Danwei.org. How are you, Jeremy?
Hi, Kaiser.
Also with us is Cynical stalwart Gadi Epstein, bureau chief of Forbes magazine here in Beijing. Good to see you, Gadi.
Happy to be a stalwart.
Yeah, and happy Hanukkah to you.
Thank you.
And joining us for the first time here is Public Radio International reporter Mary Kay Majestad, whom you doubtless know from PRI's wonderful The World, and whom we're hoping will become a regular with Cynica. Welcome to the podcast, Mary Kay.
Thanks, Chris.
Let's plug her Cole series, which started yesterday.
Cole, absolutely. So PRI The World, indispensable listening for this week. So it started on Tuesday. So please.
Called China's Cole Habit.
Right, right. A bad habit indeed. How many parts?
Four parts.
So Tuesday to Friday, make sure to listen to it. That is one of the most popular podcasts in the world, I believe. It is. It's actually right up there. So,
But your series is not incorporated in WikiLeaks cables, right?
It isn't yet.
It may well be.
And, of course, that's one of the things we'll be talking about today. Today we're doing a focus on the situation on the Korean Peninsula. On Tuesday of last week, November 23rd, North Korean forces shelled the island of Yongpyeong. Off the west coast of the peninsula, the artillery barrage, which killed two South Korean soldiers and two civilians, I believe, was ostensibly done in retaliation for military exercises that Pyongyang says violated its territory. The barrage started about 4 hours after the conclusion of those exercises, leaving very little doubt that we're not to believe that it was actually, oh, they're firing at us, let's fire back. This also comes on the heels of news earlier this month that North Korea is moving forward with the uranium enrichment program in addition to its plutonium reactor right now. Our interest is, of course, more in Beijing's reaction and where China is in all of this. And that question may have been made more complicated by the release over the weekend of a 250,000 American diplomatic cables by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Some of these cables contained assertions from Chinese diplomatic sources about North Korea. We'll talk about what these cables contained and what, if anything, they might mean for the situation. Let's start with what happened with the actual shelling. Mary Kay, why don't you start us off? Can you offer us a quick recap of what happened since the artillery barrage of the 23rd?
Well, what's happened since then is the Chinese calling an emergency press conference on Sunday afternoon and calling for emergency talks. And so far, the United States and South Korea kind of balking at that idea because they've been down that road before. This is what happened throughout the past decade. North Korea makes a threat, does something outrageous, says, now we need to talk, or China says on its behalf, now we need to talk. People get together, they talk. Agreements are reached. Some part of it is honored, most of it is not, and then we move forward to the next crisis.
It's the dance.
Indeed, and usually a part of that dance is, no, we're not going to talk, but we'll have talks in advance of having talks about why we're not going to have talks. And you, North Korea, need to do these things before we'll come to the table and talk. And that usually then involves back-channel negotiations, which I believe are also called talks, and a lot of Chinese diplomats moving around and trying to get everybody to a table, whether or not those actual talks that they result in do anything.
Whether they're six-party, three-party, bilateral talks, or what have you.
Exactly. So that's where we are now, and it's familiar. And I think you can see the frustration on the part of the U.S., Japan, and South Korea because we were through all of this starting 8 years ago. I mean, we actually have been through all of this back in 1993 and 1994 when a previous buildup by North Korea of a nuclear weapons program ended in a peace agreement – or an agreement called the Agreed Framework with the Clinton administration that Jimmy Carter helped broker, and that then basically North Korea proceeded to undermine almost immediately by developing apparently a uranium enrichment program. So then 8 years ago, that was revealed, and we had the same process go through where everybody's saying we're not going to deal with North Korea, and then eventually led to three-party talks, six-party talks. Meanwhile, they developed nuclear weapons. They've tested weapons twice. They've fired missiles. They've, made provocations. And in the last year,
and sunk a battleship, right?
And sunk Cheonan.
Right.
And in the last year, China's only looked like they've gotten more supportive of North Korea, really, basically compared to 2003.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Jeremy. You've often talked on this show about how the Western media characterizes or mischaracterizes Kim Jong Il when it describes him as insane, as in a creature that isn't ruled by anything like logic. The fact that his policies adhere to a certain logic, however perverse, seems to be this whole dance. I mean, he has this sort of blackmail dance number that he's always calling, right? That idea seems to be shared by a few scholars. I passed around a couple of readings. One, a gentleman by the name of Andrei Lankoff, based in Seoul, he argued in a New York Times editorial that North Korea actually behaves rationally, again, in a perverse way, in a kind of Machiavellian manner, that he said, by pursuing this kind of blackmail policy. Is that what you had in mind when you described him as a rational actor?
Well, this is the thing that gets me the nasty comments. It is something along those lines. I think North Korea is in a situation where they're really stuck, and the most powerful force they face essentially is the United States. Look across the DMZ at the huge and scary looking American-funded South Korean border. Post with these scary South Korean soldiers who look like they come from a science fiction film, compared to the North Koreans' little shack with their kind of World War II era outfits. The feeling in North Korea, you know, obviously it's promoted by government propaganda of being under threat, I think is very strong. And I don't think North Korea is going to do anything to weaken its position. It's just going to carry on trying to get a bomb. I think that's very clear, and I think anyone who kids themselves that that's not the case is crazy. Where I think there's a lack of imagination is perhaps that the United States should once again consider talking directly to North Korea, because China isn't going to do anything about it. To me, it's not in China's interest to do anything about it. Having an unstable North Korea is good for China in several ways. There are some people who were quoted in the WikiLeaks cables as saying that younger Chinese leaders, they're losing patience with North Korea, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure the more cosmopolitan of the younger Chinese leaders are sick of this kind of retrograde, crazy state. But there are plenty of people in China who don't feel the same way, I would imagine. Why doesn't America talk directly to North Korea? It would put China on the back foot.
That's a good question.
Is one of these things that, you know, you're not allowed to say. You're not allowed to suggest. You're not allowed to suggest talking to North Korea because they're totally crazy. Yes, they are kind of crazy, but they are crazy in a sort of logical way. They have interests which one can find a way to interact with.
And very logical in this sense. North Korea was supported by the Soviet Union until 1991 when what was then Russia cut them loose. And since then, their economy has tanked big time. So when they put something together to have a crisis happen, usually it's because they need aid. They're short on fuel. They're short on food. They're looking for some way to keep the economy going. And when I say they, I'm talking about the regime in power. What's most important to them is staying in power. So there are other options they could pursue, including having a better relationship with South Korea, but they don't see that leading to them continuing to be in the position of power that they're in.
Well, I mean, the marauding works, right? I mean, you tell the Mongols you could trade, but instead, I mean, raiding across the border gets you the payments of silk and silver.
But raiding across the border would get you bombed. So just making the occasional threatening gesture enough that people want to come and talk to
provoke,
you.
Provoke, recriminate, negotiate, rinse, repeat.
Right. Lather. Work yourself into a lather.
And that is the North Korean strategy. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they had that disastrous revaluation of their currency a year ago that, by all accounts, really torched the economy, whatever they had of it. And then in the next year, Kim Jong-il made two visits to China. That was actually interesting. In the WikiLeaks cables, there was a prediction by a South Korean official that Kim would need to visit China to seek more aid because their economy was in tatters.
Right.
That did happen. Then there's the provocations with the Cheonan, the ship, and this shelling. So clearly it is this, you know, we want to come out and negotiate with you. I believe one of my colleagues, his headline was, you know, Kim Jong-il, bang, let's talk.
Yeah.
Let's fire first and then negotiate. The thing about doing bilateral, like just U.S.-North Korea, is the problem is that you don't have much leverage if China continues to supply aid to North Korea. That's why it's always been considered crucial that China be involved in the mix.
But should we just forget about it? I mean, Aiden Foster Carter, I think that was his name? Yeah, Aiden Foster Carter. He's a Korea scholar at Leeds yeah. University. He wrote a pretty amusing but kind of depressing piece in Foreign Policy, I believe it was. Yeah, in Foreign Policy. I don't know if you all got a chance to read it. I mean, his essential thing is, you know, forget it. I mean, stop expecting that China is ever going to step up here and actually try to curb its vicious curve.
It's not. I think he's absolutely right. I mean, what they have no interest in doing it. The six-party talks mean that they get to be a big shot in an important multilateral forum, which China's government likes. The six-party talks means that the United States, Japan, and South Korea are beholden to China to a certain degree. The six-party talks mean that they are like any committee. Nothing will ever get done.
Right. Maintains the status quo while making them look like a responsible power. I agree.
Without having to fulfill any actual responsible actions. So, right. I mean, you know, what's the point? I mean, really, forget about it. The U.S. should either talk directly to North Korea or find another strategy. What that could be, I don't know.
So, Gadi, I think you – go ahead, Mary.
Sorry, two please. Thoughts. One is there's sort of a historical reason for why the U.S. has been hesitant to talk directly to North Korea, and that's the way that the Korean War was left. North Korea has always been wanting to get across a table with the U.S. as we were the two people fighting this war. South Korea was just your puppet, and we're the only two that count. And so the U.S. has been resisting it for that reason. But there's also the fact that China's playing a very long-term game in trying to keep a good relationship going with North Korea while keeping its options open with South Korea. And here there was something very interesting that came out of the WikiLeaks reports as well, a South Korean vice foreign minister saying, we were told by Chinese officials that they would be open to Korea reuniting with South Korea being in charge as long as it was a friendly state to China, even if there was a U.S. presence. You know, we could sort of handle that. Now, you have to consider the source, not that there's anything suspect about a Korean vice foreign minister, but did the Chinese officials tell him that because they're playing two different games at once? Do they really believe that? We don't know that. We just know what was in the cable.
Right, and Richard Spencer had a blog about this in The Telegraph today. I'm not sure if you saw, which basically urges us to look at the actions, not the words. And the actions seem to be, you know, consistently delaying and watering down and offering very, very tepid responses. In fact, Gadi, I think you wrote something about the nature of these tepid responses. You quoted a South Korean think tanker. What was his name?
Park Seung-jo.
Yeah. Who, I mean, correct me if this paraphrase is inaccurate, but Beijing's response to the Chonan basically, well, the weakness of the response emboldened Pyongyang and gave them enough of a leash to unleash an artillery barrage.
Yeah, that was his point. He says basically China should be held responsible pretty much for last week's artillery barrage. If they had come out more strongly against the sinking of the Chonan, which for our listeners, to remind you, this is a likely North Korean torpedoing of a South Korean naval vessel that killed 46 sailors. And China basically allowed the fact that it happened underwater and there was an investigation. You know, they kind of dragged on a little bit. They made it sound like it's ambiguous what happened and essentially stayed silent on the whole thing.
Mary Kay, would you characterize the Chinese response this time as once again very sort of Chonan-like and tepid? Like, let's get both sides of this. Let's not leap to any hasty conclusions. Let's not.
Very much so, but this is, again, consistent with playing a long-term game.
Right.
China would like to have access to the port across the border, the Beijing port. China would like to have stability across the border, however it is able to make that happen. So if it's going to be with the current North Korean regime, great. If that all falls apart, it seems like it could already be sort of making noises in the direction of, hey, you know, we can work with you. We can find a way to work with you. And as part of that whole potential plan, China has signaled 5 years back that it's interested in territory that extends into North Korea. It's got a think tank that's been doing research.
About calling, the Joseon Kingdom. And
Right, calling the founding Korean kingdom basically a provincial Chinese warlord, which has incensed both North Koreans and South Koreans. Gadi and I were both in North Korea in 2005, shortly after this came out. And this was a place where North Koreans were, you know, in sync with their South Korean brethren and being just livid about China making this claim.
This seems consistent.
Don't you think, I mean, this is the point, that China does not have an interest necessarily even in stability in the Korean Peninsula. The more unstable the Korean Peninsula is, the more opportunities there are for China to take over stuff, ports, land, launch companies.
There's chaos under
war
heaven.
Is opportunity.
Exactly.
And,
the situation is excellent.
People who believe that the powerful Chinese leaders plotting the North Korea strategy, people who believe that they are reading the texts of the Enlightenment for inspiration, are idiots. They are reading Sun Tzu's Art of War. It's okay to have the Gaoli Bangzi, you know, blowing each other up across the border. The more instability there is there, the better for China in the long run. And that's one way of thinking about it.
But
I don't think that is a minority way of thinking about it. I think you're kidding yourself if you don't face the fact that we have Maoists in charge.
Right. Hold on a second. There's a difference between Chinese leaders being like sanguine about North Korean instability and maybe recognizing just the usefulness of having a threat to U.S. interests.
Gadi, we have Chinese generals who say, look, you can nuke every city east of Xi'an and we'll be all right. I mean,
there are voices within Chinese leadership.
I'm not saying everybody is like that. I mean, some people
there are voices within Chinese leadership
like that.
Other
people are saying, you know, very America-friendly stuff. But
I am under no illusions that the Politburo Standing Committee is America-friendly. But I don't think that they also want an unstable peninsula.
Can cope with it. They have more to gain from it than the U.S.
However,
does.
What they do want is they want to just manage. I think the last 8 years have shown they want to just sort of manage it and let it be. You know, have it be at status quo, whatever. And the status quo keeps shifting.
Sure.
So their terms of what is considered success in North Korean diplomacy have shifted. You know, 8 years ago, if you told them 8 years ago, okay, well, you know, they're going to have nuclear weapons and they're going to test them a couple times. But there won't have been a war in the next 8 years, and you'll still be the people everybody look to try and make peace. They'll go, okay, we can take that.
That's a success, right. So, I mean, they have a very different way of looking at it.
The greatest number of outbound flights right now from Incheon Airport are to mainland China, right? The volume of trade between North Korea and South Korea North Korea and PRC is dwarfed by the volume of trade between...
Yeah, I think it's $3 billion for China and North Korea and about $150 billion for China and South Korea, 50 times more.
Right. So I tend to think that Chinese interests are driven, if by anything, more by economic considerations.
And I think that actually plays into this theory that maybe they would accept one day a reunified... I mean, I think that's just looking at reality. If a North Korea that gets absorbed is going to be extremely costly to the country that absorbs it. And, of course, it makes sense that South Korea absorb it because it is the Korean Peninsula. And it's going to be costly to the South Korean economy. And China will still be able to exploit aspects of that. And I think Chinese thinkers realize at the top level, realize that someday that could well happen. And so, I mean, that is basically what's behind these sort of comments. It's not that
already covering their options.
Yeah, they're just covering their long-term options.
Comments, which is right. One of the things about this whole WikiLeaks thing that I've started to realize is that I didn't think the State Department is doing a bad job judging by these cables. I mean, most of them actually, contrary to what some people believe, I look at these cables and I think these are smart people writing, sometimes very wittily, and certainly in a very articulate way about situations America has to face. It's not that bad.
No, it's not a bad thing at all. I mean, there's a lot of very clever analysis going on, I think.
Right. Actually, I was just reading just before coming here a piece in the New Republic about how there used to be a lot more clever analysis in these. And actually what they're doing is just mostly relaying information and that these cables are much more boring to read than they used to be. He said they're also more boring than the CIA cables.
I blame Twitter.
because there's a bit it's been discouraged to do too much independent sort of thinking and analysis.
Independent thinking.
These cables are not the place for it.
Right.
The cables,
something more secure would
right,
be better.
These cables are the place for basically relaying raw and not terribly sensitive on the most part data. Because remember, these are the ones that they've chosen to share, you know, with other agencies. They have to actually make an affirmative act when they enter in the information to Washington. They have to put in a code that shares it with other agencies. The more sensitive stuff, the really good stuff, you could say, doesn't get shared.
There are a couple of reasons why I think that we shouldn't dismiss out of hand this WikiLeaks cable that suggests that South Korean foreign minister had been or vice foreign minister had been told that China would entertain the idea of a unified Korea ruled from Seoul. And one of them is simply that, well, yes, there are people in China who would say this. The foreign ministry is by no means either a monolith itself or part of a monolith that speaks with one voice with, you know, the rest of the Chinese government. And I've certainly heard these ideas expressed sort of by think tankers, by intellectuals in China, especially because of the idea, and this is my second point, that it's, I think, an article of faith that a unified Korea ruled from Seoul would drift inevitably into Beijing's orbit, that it would be friendly to Beijing over Washington. What do you think of that idea?
Well, there's certainly mixed sentiments about the U.S. presence in South Korea within South Korea. I mean, basically the only thing that makes them pro-America is whenever, you know, Kim Jong-il rattles his saber.
Or when China releases a report saying that the founding Korean kingdom
was a Chinese warlord.
There were demonstrations in the streets over that.
This is a generational divide, but basically time is on China's side.
I don't know if it's an article of faith, Kaiser. I mean, I find, you know, just on a casual basis, the prejudice one can find against Koreans. You know, I said earlier, Gaoli Bangza, that's a common word you hear in Beijing, kind of derogatory way to refer to Koreans.
Sure.
Kind of like, you know, how would you translate Gaoli Bangza? Like sorghum bumpkins or something like that. I don't think there's 100% confidence in China that a unified Korea would necessarily drift more into China's orbit than the United States.
Yeah, now that I've had a chance to think about it, actually, Jeremy, I have to revise and extend my earlier remarks. China, I mean, the neighbors to China in this region right now are very wary of, you know, this rising superpower. And I think a unified Korea would not, you know, just necessarily fall into China's orbit. They'd want to try and keep a strategic distance.
I'm not really asking whether I think that that's an inevitability. I'm asking whether that's a belief that's widely held among Chinese policymakers.
I'm sure some people within China believe
I don't
that.
Think it's something that's been said publicly very much why this leak is so interesting.
Right. I think WikiLeaks is going to infest many a conversation that we have about foreign policy in years going forward. It'll be a very interesting thing. Listen, that's all we've got time for today. We wanted to keep this one short. I'd like to thank Jeremy, Gotti, and of course Mary Kay for taking time out from your busy days. And we are going to see you very shortly for a sort of bonus makeup edition of the Cynic Podcast because of the ill fate of our last week's episode. So, Mary Kay, you're sticking around. Gotti, happy Hanukkah. Off you go. Jeremy, you're sticking around.
I'm sticking around. But go, before you do anything else, go listen to Mary Kay's Cole series.
Absolutely.
www.theworld.org.
And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.